You know, it wasn't 29 palms.
Let me ask you, Marv. Anybody who listens to these interviews knows that I generally like to start at the beginning. What was your first exposure to comics?
Superman, an issue of Superman after I watched the TV show back many, many years ago.
And when did you know you wanted to do comics for a living?
I started doing fan magazines when I was a teenager, and that was sort of my entree into comics, writing my own stories, drawing them, writing articles, et cetera, et cetera.
When did you move from doing the fanzine to actually being a comics professional?
First actual sale was something was a story for a magazine called Castle of Frankenstein, and then the next one was an issue of Blackhawk. So that was about 1967.
Oh. How did you get offered that? Was that your, who came to you and helped you get into the business?
I submitted a Blackhawk story because I didn't like what was being done in the book. And a year later, a different editor happened to see it, liked it, and bought it.
Huh. Now, you said that you started out in 1967?
Yes.
I guess you've been in the industry now over 40 years. How has the industry really changed in the last 40 years?
Well, let's see. We participate a lot more towards the creation, towards the benefits of the comics. Story-wise, they're more... You know, styles change all the time, so right now we're in a very writer-driven time period, so I like that a lot. But we go back and forth between that and art-driven and strong stories and weaker stories and long plots and shorter plots. Essentially, it's stylistic changes and an audience change. It used to be kids 8 to 14. Now I think the average age starts in their mid-20s. So you can write more mature books, you can write older books, plus you still can write comics for kids, but essentially we're writing for an older audience today, so we can get in and do a lot deeper stories if we want.
Speaking of how things change, as someone who is incredibly well-received for his work on Tomb of Dracula, and taking, you know, some of Bram Stoker's basic work and really developing a big mythology and introducing a lot of characters and really doing great comics in the 70s at Marvel. What do you think about the shiny vampires that proliferate media today?
I look at a lot of them, and I have to be honest, not because I did vampires, but because the very concept of it, these are undead souls supposedly, and it sounds a little bit over the top that they would be these star-crossed lover types. So I find it very amusing, but people seem to like it, and they're a different breed of vampire, but I don't follow a lot of it, to be honest. I'm not really that interested in what other people do.
You have any interest in returning to that sort of character if the other stylistic idea of vampire ever came back around, or would you like to bring it back around?
I think that multiple styles of vampire mythology can exist all at once. That's just one of them, and that's for the teenage girls primarily, which are these, you know, the whole Twilight Saga, or even the Vampire Diaries, or some of the other shows that are on TV. I think they could exist simultaneously, or there are audiences for different type of horror, and you would just have to aim the stories for them. But I do horror stories. I'm starting a brand new horror book at DC, which I can't mention what it is, but I can tell you I'm doing more adult horror stories right now.
Excellent. I always like when DC dips their toe in that a little bit. We talk with Steve Niles frequently and liked the idea that they let him run with Simon Dark for a little while. Hopefully the project that you're going to start that you can't name yet will get a little more length than Steve did with Simon Dark.
It's a very difficult field to break into at a big company because sales have to be a lot higher than, say, at an independent company, simply because of the costs involved at a major company like DC and Marvel. So their sales need to be higher, and the audience for books like this are not quite as great as, say, the audience for, you know, superheroes. When I do those, you know, I can be guaranteed a much larger sale. On the other hand, I think if, as digital comics come more available and we can reach out to a different type of audience, we may be able to do horror stories for them, because horror is so well loved outside of the comic industry. Now it's a matter of finding those people and bringing them to us.
Because of kind of what you just said, you have some companies like, say, Dark Horse and IDW and Boom Studios that are dipping, you know, instead of dipping a toe in, they're dipping a foot or the whole leg maybe sometimes into the horror genre. Do you have any interest in possibly joining maybe another company that's doing a little more of that to expand some of the horror, or are you, you know, kind of happy with the opportunity you're getting at DC?
Well, since I'm exclusive to DC, I don't think that I will be going elsewhere. And I'm thrilled to be able to do a horror book there, because it's one I want to do.
Okay, I actually was completely unaware that you had an exclusive to DC right now. Yes. That's great.
Well, let me ask you, Marv, as somebody who seems to be able to flip from genre to genre, what is it about the horror genre that keeps bringing you back to it?
Horror and comedy are the only two genres that exist that appeal to emotion. All the other genres are more cerebral, even superhero material or detective stories or science fiction. You can do stories of all kinds there, but if a horror story doesn't actually grip you and make you a little bit nervous or give you a sense of horror, and if comedy doesn't make you laugh, you fail. So those things can't be hidden. Those things can't be disguised. A superhero story or a science fiction story, they're far more cerebral in the way you handle them, because you're not going for the emotion. You're going for plot and twist and character and a lot of other type stories. So every so often I love to go right back to sort of grabbing you by the throat, because in horror I can do that, whereas it's much, much more difficult to do that in other genres.
Doing horror in a comic book seems like it would be extraordinarily tough in that, well, let's say that you're doing a vampire story in the movies or whatever. You've got the editing, you've got the sound effects, you've got the musical cues, you've got that tension. Let me try to ask it this way. When you read a comic book, even if you're not consciously aware of it, you're kind of scanning ahead. How do you build tension and drama in a visual medium and still keep the element of surprise?
Well, you have to be aware of where your page breaks are. So you have to know if it's a right-hand page or a left-hand page. And if you can create your story to have a punchline on the right-hand page, it forces the person to turn it, so therefore there isn't a surprise being given away. There's a lot of different tricks that one uses. And the other thing is you just have to go with the medium and deal with it that way. Every business is slightly different.
Obviously, The Walking Dead and a lot of what Boom Studios is doing is really getting a lot of attention. Who do you think is doing horror comics right these days?
I hate to give you an answer like this, but I don't read them. I just don't read a lot of those type of comics, because when I'm doing similar type stuff, I don't want to be influenced by them. My interests tend to be a little bit more on reading the horror novels or books or things of that sort. Something that is not in the same field that I do. So I just don't read the material.
Okay. Well, let me ask you then, what novels are on your shelf right now?
Oh, God. Well, at this particular moment, I'm going through a mystery craze. So it's a bad time to bring that one up. But I'm going through a lot of just detective stories. But, you know, everything changes. I'm constantly reading. Most of the stuff that I read, at least half of what I read is nonfiction, because I really enjoy that. A lot of what I do is try to get away from the type of thing that I do normally, so that I'm neither copying something, following something, or influenced too much by it. Horror, because it's personal, I like to come out of my own thinking. A lot of the stories that I do that are horror-driven come out of what's happening in the world, and then I flip them into a different type of story that works as a horror story. So I'll take something that may be political or religious or some news, and then try to turn that into a story that would be a horror story.
Well, what scares you?
Personally? Not that much. Heights. I have a terrible fear of falling. I'm not somebody who believes in the fiction, though I really find uh, I don't watch a lot of horror films because they are disturbing, and I mean that in the right way, not in the wrong way. They can creep you out because of the music and the editing and just the way it's done, if they're well done. A movie like The Ring a couple of years ago, where it's original, The Ringo, those were incredibly creepy. But what happens is, after a while, the same type of stories keep getting redone, and they lose their impact.
What's the biggest difference for you when writing a script specifically for horror, for the artist? Do you feel that you have to be more descriptive to try to build the suspense that you would have visually, like comparing it to movies? Or do you find that you need an artist that's just going to kind of immediately go there himself and realize that it's a very different type of storytelling than, say, you know, Superman fighting Darkseid?
Yeah, you're correct on both parts. When I do horror, I tend to be far more descriptive in my panels because I'm trying to talk about the mood of it as well as what's going on, and I may want to break down a scene very differently. So I tend to do very strong descriptions. But my preference, and unfortunately because I'm not the editor and I'm not in charge in any fashion, I don't get the choice always of knowing who the artist is in advance. You know, sometimes you're working with an artist who is great, and sometimes you're working with an artist who is really good but for a different field or a different type of book, and it doesn't always come together. Now, we haven't chosen an artist for this. I just handed in the first six issues worth of plots for approval before we even start to look for an artist, because we want to find somebody, hopefully, whose style will fit the storyline that I'm coming up with. And, you know, I was blessed with Tomb of Dracula and a lot of other stories to work with Gene Colan. And there's almost nobody better. But there aren't a lot of Gene Colans out there. I'm only hoping that the new book that I'm working on, we can find a really good artist who meshes with the type of thinking that I'm trying to do, and the two of us could produce a good horror book.
As you sort of mentioned when talking about the movies and the horror genre, but also with comics as well, as you said, things can be very graphic. Is there anything with back in the 70s with Tomb of Dracula and now today with the new book that you're going to be working on, are there things that were very out of line previously and now are up for grabs? Or, you know, were there things that you couldn't do with Tomb of Dracula now that you still can't do, or things that you couldn't do that you might be able to get away with now? How has the content level been adjusted for that time frame with horror stories and comics?
Well, simply, we had the Comics Code back then, and comics were done for a younger audience. Now, Tomb of Dracula was written for an older audience, but older in terms of the audience that existed at the time, it still wasn't considered to be, you know, 30-year-olds and up. Therefore, though I got away with an awful lot of stuff, I wasn't able to touch on religion, I wasn't able to touch on sex, I wasn't able to touch on a lot of subjects that were taboo for kids because they were Comics Code. Now we're dealing with, first of all, it's a different world. Many of those things don't have the impact that they may have had previously because so many people have dealt with them, but on the other hand, we're no longer prevented from touching on those areas or trying something that's maybe over the top or trying to find something that is hasn't been done that much. But, you know, we're not alone in comics. People who buy comics also see movies, and they also read books, and they also watch television, and they buy video games, and everybody sees so much of this material now. The thing that I try to do when I do a horror story or in comics is to make and to come up with interesting characters and come up with a storyline that has some unique flavor to it that's a little bit different. But you can't be as graphic, certainly, as you are in a movie, because they could show anything. They could show somebody being completely eviscerated on screen and they'll just get an R rating. We can do it, but it's a still picture, so it doesn't have the same impact. We have to do it through structure and through pacing.
You mentioned creating characters, and I'm just kind of curious, looking at your Wikipedia, just the number of characters that you've created that are still around today, you know, Tim Drake, Terra, Deathstroke, Bullseye, Blade, just on and on and on and on, that are still being used today. How do you go about creating your characters?
First of all, I take time. And the Wikipedia is the entry there is very short on the number of characters I've actually created that have gone, that have continued. But again, it's the same as I was saying with horror comics. You try to come up with something that's unique. You don't just send something out there. I have probably just as many failures, but I will constantly be trying to do something a little bit different. And when I try to come up with a character, I want it to solve a problem that doesn't currently exist. So I'm not going to repeat the same type of character that's out there. If I want a mercenary, I'm not going to create the same type of mercenary somebody else has or even touch on the same type of subject matter. So sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't, but you have to try. I don't like it when I look at a lot of comics and no new characters are ever introduced because nobody wants to create or nobody knows how to.
Well, speaking directly of creating new characters and really running with it, you know, as much as you're known for Tomb of Dracula, you're probably a lot more well-known for your work on the new Teen Titans.
Yeah, right.
How did that job come about with you and George Perez forming that tandem? I mean, you were on Teen Titans book previous to that, but how specifically did the new Teen Titans series come about with you and George jumping on board?
What happened was I left Marvel and came to DC, and I had asked only one thing, that I not be put on crossover books, you know, like Raven Bold and World's Finest, because I don't like those type of books, and I had just done 2 years on Marvel 2-in-1, so I really didn't want to do that anymore. But DC assigned me to 2 team-up books, so I wanted to get off those as fast as possible. And since I did like the Teen Titans, and I had done it back in the 70s and late 60s, I came up with the characters and proposed a new one. And they okayed it after a bit. And then I happened to be up at Marvel for some reason. I don't even remember why. And I ran into George and mentioned I was doing it. And he said that he'd be interested in drawing it, but he really wanted to draw Justice League. So I brought him over to DC, and he started working on both. But because Titans was a book that we created, he tended to gravitate towards that a lot more.
One of the things that really stuck out for me as a young reader, and Titans, New Teen Titans was my favorite, absolute favorite book during that time period, it seemed rare to me at that time to see the co-creator, to see the, you know, co-plotter and things like that that you and George had. How tight was that working relationship? Because most of the books I would pick up, you know, you'd have, and even today, you have a writer, you have an artist. There's not that sort of necessarily bond of teamwork like it seemed for so much of that Titan series between you and George.
George and I had worked before, obviously, and we knew how each other worked. We hadn't been as close friends as we had become pretty fast afterwards because we were working regularly together on the Titans. But I'd say the first 20 issues or so, with a couple exceptions, were all from very tight plots that I came up with. But then George moved in with issue 8. George actually made some recommendations, and we worked it out together, and he came up with some brilliant sequences. And it was very obvious that he's as good a storyteller as he is an artist. Also, when we worked together, even though my plots were very, very tight, they'd be 8 to 10 pages for a 25-page story, George was always free to take them and paste them and do with them what he wanted, and he always plussed it. Then George moved to the same town that I was in. In fact, we only live 4 blocks apart. And once that happened, we tended to get together on a regular basis. I'd come in with the basic idea for the story, and then we'd start talking about it together and break it down together. And once we started to do that, where I wasn't handing in a written, you know, a finished plot to George for him to draw, that's when I said, well, we're both the co-plotters on this because we're sitting there together. In many cases in comics, that's the way it was. The only difference is that the writers didn't want to acknowledge the artist or didn't want to give them credit or something. And I felt that George was not only a co-plotter, he was the co-creator of the comic. And if we're sitting together, both names should be involved. I'm then going off and doing all the dialogue. You know, I may come up with the basic concept for the story, but if he's pacing it out with me at a diner for 6 hours and we're breaking it down page by page, we should both get the credit for it, not just me.
Now, a lot of times in that series, eventually George, you know, went to other projects and things like that, and you guys weren't together as much. Do you feel that the series kind of suffered from that lack of synergy when you teamed with other people later on in the runs?
Well, a lot of those people didn't even live in New York. In fact, almost none of them lived in New York. But the problem really was that we had created the characters together, and George was so good at character drawing that he could pose a character in such a way that you knew everything they were thinking because he understood those characters inside and out. So it freed me up to write characterization dialogue. I didn't have to explain plot a lot. I didn't have to, because the plot came out through the artwork, which is the way it's supposed to, but you don't always get because 99% of the artists weren't even close to George in those terms. So what happened was, after he left, the plots were probably just as strong in many ways because I had been, I did plot, as I say, the first 20 issues. But what happened was the characters didn't feel right. And since we were doing it plot style, not script style, my dialogue suddenly had to become a little bit more expository to explain what was going on, as well as trying to do the characters. So the book changed in the tone, and it didn't change for the better. And with time, it started to become repetitious, and those things happened, and I probably should have gotten off the book after about 10 years, but I was on for 16 because I love the characters, but I had pretty much, you know, run out of ideas. I was doing for a while 2 books a month on that, so, you know, and I did about 250 of them, so if 150 were good, overall, I'm pretty happy, but when you work with someone and you co-create something, the two of you are the unit that makes it. And there was no way that, even if the artist was Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, who's probably, George would consider the best, one of the best artists ever. I mean, he would say that to you. And the stories that we did together were just utterly gorgeous, but it didn't feel the same. And the book that George and I did was very unique to the two of us. Yeah.
Like you and George really collaborated in, guess what's called, the old Marvel style, at least initially.
All the issues of the Titans were done Marvel style.
Is that something you brought over from Marvel? Do you feel more comfortable working that way? Or
no, well, it was obvious to do that with George, but I had done that with other artists, too, who knew how to do it. A lot of DC artists didn't know how to work that way, and for them, I'd write full scripts. But if they could work that way, I really enjoyed working it in the plot style, because the artists were encouraged to add things to it, and they were encouraged to participate, and they felt that they were more important than just drawing specifically the pictures that I asked for. But I did that sort of work with many people, and in fact, back in the 70s, before I moved to Marvel from DC, I did a number of stories at DC in that style, too.
You know, your run on Teen Titans seems to be second only. I kind of, in my mind, put it right up there with Claremont's run on the X-Men. You just kind of built and built and built. And, you know, you say that you did about 250 stories and only maybe, if you got 150 good ones. I don't think there was really a bad one in the bunch.
Well, near the end, it really fell apart. But I wasn't plotting the book at the time, so I really don't like most of those. I think that, I thank you, but it's hard to keep up that many stories and constantly be fresh. I should have at some point taken a couple years off and then come back, and I would have new ideas again. But when you're trying to turn out sometimes 2 Titan stories a month, it's hard to constantly keep fresh and keep yourself excited, and no matter how much you love the characters, something's going to suffer. It did, you know, but again, I was on the book for 16 years. Very few people have had runs like that. So I consider the run very, very good. And it's a book I love. And in fact, George and I are doing a Titans graphic novel now. So, you know, it never seems to be far from me.
Which do you think kind of brought more pressure working with those characters and that franchise? Do you think that, you know, you and then George and other artists put the pressure on yourself? Or was there pressure from DC that you had created what became a flagship title for them, and now you needed to upkeep it? It was great that you won a Super Bowl, but they wanted a lot more Super Bowls from you. Do you think the pressure was greater on you, or do you think the pressure was greater from the company?
You know, outside of competing with myself, I don't think the company ever said anything one way or the other. They were happy that the sales of the book were good, the critical response to the book was good. Only much later on, when I started to do material that wasn't quite up to that, did they start trying to goose it up, and they did it by trying to find me editors who could work with me, because I had moved to California, so I obviously wasn't able to edit. When I was in New York, I could do that. And they went through various ones until we found a couple who clicked really well, who understood the material and could sort of get the best out of me. But ultimately, as in all things, you at some point you need to just move on.
You mentioned the games graphic novel that you guys will be doing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But you and George also did some, I believe, some preliminary work for one of DC's, you know, adaptation animation that hasn't come to light yet, that was going to be based on the Judas Contract. That's probably the most, I guess, well-known storyline from the Titans days. What do you have to say about that particular storyline, and what was your favorite storyline that you worked on with that book?
George was never involved with the animated movie. The reason was we never got that far. I wrote a first draft script, and Warner's is primarily centering on the Justice League characters. It never got to the point where George would have been involved. He was interested. Had we gone to the next step, if I had done a second draft and we were going to storyboards, he may have been coming in to help design it. But it never got that far, so he actually never did. And I only did one draft. And the project is on hold until the Teen Titans becomes the type of title that they want to follow through on in that style.
What do you think about that particular storyline from the comic books standpoint? Is that one that stands out for you, because it seems like it's the one that really stands out for most fans?
It's obviously the strongest of the stories, and it's one that we had worked out in advance. When I first came in with the idea of doing this sort of reverse hero story, we knew what we had, and George and I plotted that one out step by step together. And the only hard thing was making sure that we never step back on Terra and let her live or let her change or do anything. We knew what we wanted. We knew how we wanted to do it. And it's probably one of the strongest stories. There are others, though, that we really like just as much. But that particular story was fairly unique at the time. And I think because it built very slowly and then suddenly surprised everyone, it's remembered as fondly as it is. But it's one of my favorite stories, but there are others as well.
I remember it very fondly because I'm one of my favorite characters in comics is Richard Grayson. So also one of the reasons why I like that story so much is that you were tasked with converting him from Robin, the somewhat adult wonder, into an entirely new character of Nightwing. Can you talk about how that came about at DC and what your thoughts were about making that sort of shift with such an iconic character?
Well, it came about because the editor of Batman decided he wanted Robin back in the Batman comic, and they wanted to de-age him to be a kid. And I said, no, I want Dick Grayson, because I've been working with him for 10 years, 12 years, and have changed the character drastically. So I suggested that they take Robin, but I keep Dick Grayson. And I suggested that they create a new Robin and make that a big publicity point, that they were going to create the first new Robin in 50 years or whatever. And meanwhile, I can keep Dick Grayson, who was vital to the Teen Titans. So that's how that happened.
You're actually a pretty prolific or meaningful creator for Robins in general, because you also created Tim Drake. Was that something that you were asked specifically to do with that Batman run that you did, or was that sort of your idea to create the third and current Robin? Well, he's not current now, I guess, but the third Robin.
No, they asked me to create a new Robin, and actually they asked me what I would do if I were to create a new Robin. And I pitched Tim Drake and the concept of Tim Drake, and that's the one they decided to go with, because I wanted to do a different type of Robin this time, not the same concept.
Did you ever get any sort of feedback from Bob Kane or any other previous creators about your work with those characters and even creating and working on stories with later Robins?
No, I don't think Bob ever even looked at the books. I have no idea. The only people I've ever gotten feedback from were Siegel and Schuster on my Superman stories, and they really liked them. And they sent me congratulatory letters, and that was a thrill. But I never heard anything from Bob Kane.
When we first started talking about the Titans book, you know, you said that you had basically a pitch together with these characters for the series when you got started. It's obvious after the last couple of minutes that Dick Grayson was my favorite Titans character. Is there one that you particularly latched on to that you really got the most out of when you were doing the series?
Probably Raven.
Is her father also maybe your favorite villain that you've gone through?
No, Deathstroke is probably the best one of those, followed by Brother Blood, because their origins and their stories are very complex, as is the story of Raven. Trigon is an incredibly powerful character, and there is a strong background to him, but it's not nearly as strong as the other two, because he's more of a force of nature rather than a grounded character.
Created all these characters, like I said, two things. Number one, how do you feel about these characters that, you know, you, I guess, birth, for lack of a better word, and then they're handed off to other people? How do you feel about how your characters have generally been handled, and who do you think has been handled the best?
I make it a policy not to read anything I create after I leave it. Part of the reason is I don't care if the writer is better than me, worse than me, or whatever. They're not going to be able to dig into my mind and see what I would do with a character. Since I never asked the previous writers of any book I've taken over, and I never asked, you know, how I should handle Robin or how I should handle Wonder Girl or any of that to the people who either created or certainly developed them, I didn't want to be put in a position where anybody would ask me or worry about whether I like their project or not. So I find it's a lot easier just not to look at it. I just have no idea what the other people have done to any great extent. The only time I've read any Titan stuff that isn't by me was some Geoff Johns stories, and they were very good because he asked me to write a couple of issues, and so I had to read a number of his in order to catch up on where his characters were. And I thought they were very good, but that's the only reason I read them. So I read, you know, Geoff's other work. Green Lantern is great. Flash is great. But I avoid reading characters that I created when anybody else writes them.
Marv, we mentioned earlier about the games graphic novel that you and George, and I'm the comics manager for my local comic book store, and was delighted in the last previews when I actually had games to order. What can you tell us about the long development of this book and about finally getting it published and out there?
Well, it's still not finished. So I'm not quite sure exactly what day it's coming out at this particular point. But about 100 pages are done now. So we are closing in on the end. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm having a lot of fun. We're changing an awful lot of the original story, which is why it's not done yet. We're not just following the old plot. When we did it originally, it was going to be a big action-type story because we were on the comic, and we were doing all of our characterization and strong stuff there, and we wanted to do a big, fun Teen Titans story. 30 years later, or 25 years later, that would be very empty if that's all we did right now. So we're changing an awful lot of that story, and that means that it's taking a little bit more time. All the plots finished. George has finished about 100 pages. He's got about 20 left.
Was it very hard to jump back into such a specific time period with those characters, even as well as you guys knew them, or was it, you know, like putting on an old pair of tennis shoes?
It's exactly putting on an old pair of tennis shoes, and I didn't expect that. But it's not written in the same style, I can tell you that, because that's a very old-fashioned style at this particular point. It's very, very heavy in dialogue. It's very, very heavy in captions and very melodramatic, which was fine when you were between 8 and 25 at that particular time period. But everyone reading it today, if I wrote it 100%, if I was capable of writing it exactly the way I wrote the best Titan story, it would feel old. It would just look, it would feel like I was writing dated copy, and it would not go over. Plot-wise, we wanted to play with it a little bit. And we've come up with a whole bunch of new things that when the editor saw what we're doing, really loved it. George's work is brilliant. I've dialogued close to 90 of the pages. The only reason I haven't gone to the full 100 is that I don't want to dialogue until the sequences are finished. So it's a lot clearer exactly how to pace out the dialogue. I know where the scenes end. It's written today, but the characters very, very much sound like they used to. Only there's not, I can say today, in 10 words, what 30 words, you know, I would have used 30 words before. So I'm using 10 good words instead of 30 so words.
Were you a little hesitant going back to the Teen Titans? Because, you know, comparisons to your original run are going to be inevitable at some point. Did that give you kind of a reason to pause and think maybe I shouldn't go back and finish this up?
Yeah, of course. Steve Ditko once told me that he would not do any Spider-Man work because no matter how good his artwork was, it would never be as good as people's memory of his artwork. And it's absolutely true. This story is not the kind of story, you know, that's going to be in competition with the Judas Contract or Who is Donna Troy or something of that sort, because that's not what the purpose of the story was. It's a solid Titan story, and it's a really good Titan story. I'm very, very pleased with it. But, of course, we're going to get comments on it. Most of the plot was designed in 1987. The first 80 or so pages, or 70 pages, were drawn back then. The rest of it is being done today. All the dialogue, I never dialogued a single page back then, so all the dialogue is new. Of course people are going to compare, and there is no way, if we would have started today and it was the greatest Titan story that we ever did, and far better than, you know, whatever, I can't even imagine what, you know, it was better than Watchmen, say. People still wouldn't think it was as good as the Titan story they read when they were 14. So what we're concerned with is not worrying about that, which is why I did it and why George decided to do it, but just do what we wanted to do, a good Titan story. We wanted to have fun going back to those characters in a story that we already liked but never finished, play with it a bit, and do it. And not worry about whether people are going to say it's not as good as, or it's better than, or whatever else. We're doing it for ourselves.
As we kind of continue to talk about George a little bit, Crisis on Infinite Earths was kind of the first, or maybe it was exactly the first, big, huge company crossover.
Yeah, it was the first.
Now it seems like that's the sort of thing that happens every summer. What was it like to do the first one? What was it like to do that series?
Well, nobody thought it would do that well. Nobody quite wanted to, quite understood what we were doing. Fortunately, the editor-in-chief at DC did, and the publisher did, so that's how we got it done. But it scared a lot of people. It scared the editors at the time, none of whom are in the business, by the way, today. It scared a lot of people because nobody had tried it before, and nobody was sure it would do well or be good or would even be the right thing to do. Fortunately, and it's one of those times that I'll say that we did a really good job, and we did it right the first time without anything to base it on, and people still remember it today and still talk about it today. And when DC reprinted it for the first time after 20 years, the thing sold through the roof because people still love that story. So, you know, I couldn't be more pleased.
Something that you just said really sticks with me about that series is that you guys didn't have, there was no sort of template. There wasn't the idea that, oh, we have to hit this, and in the third issue, somebody has to die, and we have to have three little crossover miniseries. You guys were just trying to tell this huge story as best you could, and that I think that really stands out with the against the crossovers of today that are kind of done because, well, it's August, we need our yearly crossover sort of a thing.
Well, you know, it took me several years to plot that story. It was announced many years before it actually came out, and it took a long time to get all of that plot. It's a very complex plot. It needed to surprise people on a regular basis, and it needed to do so many different things that most people aren't even aware of because nothing like it had been done. So there's a lot of little subtle stuff in there that I had time to work out. A lot of the people today don't get that time. But on the other hand, both companies have done some really, really brilliant crossovers because there's a new generation of writers that started about 8 years ago, and those guys are really good, almost all of them at both companies. So those guys are doing some nice work.
Out of Crisis, a lot of different things happened. Barry died. Everything was consolidated into one universe. And now DC seems to be slowly just unraveling everything that you set up and that you gave them to play with. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I'm the last one to have a comment about it because I unraveled everything they had done for the 30 years before that. So, you know, how can I complain that somebody does that when I did it? So I have no problem with it whatsoever. As long as it's good and as long as there's a reason for it, go ahead. You know, we should reinvent our comics every 20 years, in my mind, because you should always be fresh.
I think that's a fantastic answer. Like, it stings me a little bit, though. I remember as a teenager crying when Supergirl and Flash have their death scenes. I think those two issues, even in that crossover, stand out as some of the most memorable comics that I've ever read.
Spoilers.
Does it sting at all when you see those characters rebirth? It's like, man, you can't write a better death scene than that, and now he's back, you know, doing whatever.
You know, no, it doesn't, because I assume they'd bring back characters at some point. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. Somebody used to say, I forget who the author was, when asked, what do you think about when they make a movie of your work and do such a bad movie? And he says, well, my story's still there. And that's the same feeling that I have. I told a 12-issue story with George, and he and I did the best job we could, and it's now published in a beautiful omnibus edition with great color and great paper, and it still exists exactly the way we did it. And what more can I ask for? The business keeps moving on, and as I say, I made changes. I killed off characters. I can't complain if they decide to kill off other characters or bring back characters, because I did it, and they have the same right to do it, and fortunately, some of the people who are doing it today are really good, and that's great. If they were bad, I'd probably feel bad, but they're doing a lot of that stuff so well that you just want to read it and see where they're going with it.
I think that's a very good answer. I think probably a lot of fans, myself included, could stand to think that way instead of just being pissed off about it. One question about the Barry Allen specifically, though, is, and this may be just internet misreading, but I thought that I read an interview one time where you said that you wrote into Barry Allen's death issue a loophole to bring him back, and that wasn't obviously used because he stayed not with us for a very long time. Is that true? And if it is true, could you tell us what it is?
Well, yes, it's true. But I've been asked the question so many times, I just decided to put it on my website because I got tired of answering it. And it's on the MarvWolfman.com and then under questions and answers, and you could find it there.
Excellent.
So everybody
That's
listening
awesome.
Has to go to MarvWolfman.com and they go to questions and answers, Q&A, and you'll find the answer there. But
That's
remember, I wrote
Great
it in 1986.
I saw an interview with Mark Hamill once, and somebody asked him if he ever got tired of talking about Star Wars. And he says, well, some days yes, some days no. And do you ever get tired of, I mean, you've been very generous at answering our questions, but when you go do shows, do you get tired of the same, let's say, 10 questions about Teen Titans, about Crisis, about, is it just that you just don't want to talk about it? Let's talk about something else, let's say Tomb of Dracula, let's talk about some small run I did. Do you get tired of just the people coming back to the same, as good as those stories were, just continuing to hammer the same stories over and over again? Because you've done a lot more work than just that.
Well, thank you. When we used to do comics, and it's not done this way anymore, but we were all instructed to remember that every issue of a comic is somebody's first issue. So it's their first time asking me that question. I may have heard it a million times. I may have written 200 Teen Titans, and then somebody else comes into it and starts with my 201st story. I've already done 200, but for them it's their first. So you have to treat them and their answer, if I'm going to a convention, with as much enthusiasm and alertness as I can manage at the moment, because, you know, I could be tired. But you have to remember, it's their first time asking that question, and for them it's as important as the person who asked me that question 25 years before. So you can't get angry at it. You try to do it. You try to give the answer as enthusiastically as you can for them, not for you.
Great answer. Now, I've done a lot of these interviews, and I've always meant to ask. Now, you've done a lot of work, and when I go down to my local Borders, you know, and you look at the shelf, I see a lot of trade paperbacks with your name on it. What is that like for you to be able to walk into a Borders, Barnes & Noble, you know, whatever, and just see your name sitting there on the shelf?
It's fun. You know, it never gets old. I enjoy it. But, I've been doing this, and I'm still so enthusiastic about the writing I do today. And I do a lot of writing. I'm probably busier right now than I've ever been. But it's always exciting when something new comes out, especially if it comes out and it's good.
That's one of the changes in the industry that I'm most positive about, is the bigger, better editions that you're getting. Is that one of the things that you like about the industry? Like you mentioned, the fantastic deluxe editions that DC has done with Crisis. And when Games does come out, it's going to come out first in a really nice hardcover edition, I believe. Is that one of the things that you really like about the current path of the industry?
Yeah, one of the things that all of us disliked was that comics came out for a month and then were gone. The collected editions and these special books, they can be on the newsstand and they could be available for years upon years. If we've done a really good story, we don't want them vanishing. When George and I did the Terra storyline, or the Donna Troy story, or the marriage, or the whatever story it was that somebody specifically likes, that story was out for 2.5 weeks and then gone. We had no concept that they would be reprinted. A good story is going to be a good story. Styles will change, and people will look back at it and say, that feels very old, especially if they're a new reader and they're used to the current style. But the fact is that those stories are still out there, and they could still make an impact, and that's good.
Well, now, I was listening to an interview with, I think it was Brian Hitch, talking about the lateness of the Ultimates and how he would prefer, he's not thinking of the individual issues, he's thinking how to read as a trade. And now, according to my reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, Marv, you were one of the innovators of the idea of warehousing stories when you worked at Marvel, so you wouldn't be late. Is that right?
Yes. You look at, the first Ultimate series that Marvel did, the one that Mark Miller wrote. I think Mark Miller wrote it, right? Which is brilliant. Would you have wanted 11 of those to come out that were utterly brilliant, and then one done by somebody else and it wasn't as good? Right. Or would you like to have seen Alan Moore miss issue 9 of The Watchmen because he was late? When they're a unique item, when they are absolutely an auteur type of book, it's best to wait for that. The difference that I would have, because most of those are miniseries or even maxi series, is that I would want virtually all of them finished before I publish them so that they wouldn't miss any issues or deadlines. Coming out too early is not a good idea, because especially if you're going to be late later on. I would really want to protect it in that fashion, but I would build that into the schedule. That's the only difference. But you don't want to have a fill-in on those type of things. On a regular issue of Fantastic Four or Superman or something like that, if you have to have a fill-in, people will accept it rather than a reprint. Or today, they just don't publish the book. You know, they'll have 8 issues this year instead of 12. We didn't have that freedom.
Yeah, obviously, if it's a mini-series, maxi-series, definitely it's better to get the quality work out. But lately with Civil War and some of the others, Marvel's shipped extremely late on a lot of things, even on their monthly titles. So do you think, for a monthly title, do you think it's better to, these days, considering how everything is going to end up being traded at some point, do you think it's better to go ahead and miss that month, get caught up and put out a quality story? Do you think it's better now to just keep a fill-in?
What I would do is I would actually figure out how fast the team is. And for instance, on, let's use the Fantastic Four. If the team can only do 11 issues, maybe get them started and have an issue or two by somebody else first, and make sure that they don't, that during their issue 11 issue run, they don't they're on time by starting them today, but don't publish it for a few months. because comics are moving far more into the collected editions, which I think are going to be the major place that you're going to buy comics, printed comics from now on, it's vital that those stories be good. But it behooves the companies to figure out how to protect the deadlines at the same time. And sometimes you're going to have to bring in another really good team to do a two-issue story. And there are so many good talents today that that's not impossible. But don't schedule a miniseries by Kevin Smith on the Black Cat until he's finished them, because you know he's a movie person and is not going to have the time. So you don't have a situation where three issues came out and then a year or two later the last one did. Wait till all four of them are done. It's better for the reader, and it's also better for the reputation of the creators. It's not his fault that he had to go make a movie. I'm sure he said, this may come up, and I'm going to have to do it. But you don't print the books until you get all the stories finished.
I think that's a fantastic point that you just made, and a really good example of that point that you just made. When you broke into the business, it seems like editorship in the big companies was much more of a company art form, where everyone who was an editor seemed to be a really big name in the business, so that if if a writer, an artist was having a problem, they had somebody who had been there before that they could really talk to about it. Or if they needed, the writer and the artist needed a kick in the butt, Dick Giordano could kick them in the butt. Nowadays, that doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem from the outside looking in that that's always the case. Do you find that editing and editors in comics is something that has made any sort of slide nowadays, or is that just fanboys wanting to make trouble?
I'm very fortunate because I'm working with a bunch of really good editors, and I think there's some really good editors in the business. I don't work with everybody, so I can't tell you about, I can only tell you the people that I work with, and they are good. But it's a different industry now, very highly competitive. So if you don't want to lose a certain talent, sometimes you have to put up with certain things, because that talent is going to draw in the readers. It's like you pay a certain amount of money for a baseball player because that baseball player is going to put people into the stadium, or a basketball player, or whatever else. It's the same now with the very, very top talent. Certain people are going to guarantee X sales, and that means when you have a situation like that, you have to deal with it in a very different way than it was dealt with in the days where everybody was interchangeable, where they didn't even bother putting credits on the books. Because it's a different circumstance, you have to deal with it in a different fashion. I don't know if the way people have chosen to deal with it is the best or not, but it is very different, and it's much harder today to be an editor because of that than it used to be. Previously, it was a generation of creators who grew up during the Great Depression, and they were happy for a job, and they didn't leave, and they turned out two or three books a month, and they just did that, and that was their ethic. Today, somebody may want to spend, I've known artists who just feel like spending days upon days on one page to make it the most beautiful page in the world, and that screws up the deadline, but how do you complain, because they're concerned about their work? So it's a different world.
You mentioned earlier that you thought that trades are going to be the wave of the future. Do you think that getting two trades a year versus, let's say, 12 floppies, do you think that's a positive thing for the industry, or do you think it's going to be more of a negative thing in that companies aren't going to be willing to shell out for six issues to see if it's going to right off the bat?
You're asking several different questions. My belief is that over the next 3 to 5 years, most monthly comics are going to go digital, and the collected editions are going to be the books that are sold in the stores. Ultimately, you'll have just as many collected editions as, there'll be regular weekly shipments of collected editions in. And what the reader will get out of it, if they bought the monthlies, they have the collected. Otherwise, if they're buying it for the first time, they're getting an entire story. The monthly comics are too expensive for that size. But the collected editions are well priced for that size, for their size. It's hard at $3.95 for 22 pages. Yet $10.95 for 80 pages is not bad, with a better cover, better printed cover on heavier stock. Mm-hmm. So I see that as a positive, because again, the stories will be out there, And I think if you know that you're working for writing a novel, in a sense, you're going to get stronger stories ultimately.
With you mentioned Price County specifically there, and as both a retailer and someone with a small paycheck from being a retailer, price is always of consideration to me, even when buying something I love like comics. Do you think that the digital medium is a way to help increase what most people consider a shrinking readership? And do you think that's the easiest way to do that if money is an issue because of the shrinking readership?
Well, let me ask you right off the top. You're a retailer. How many retail shops are there?
Nationwide or just in my area?
Nationwide.
Nationwide? Shrinking a lot. I would say there's probably still maybe thousands, hopefully.
Well, there's fewer than 2,000.
Okay.
Okay. Consider L.A. has maybe 12 shops. New York has more than that. How many in your area?
There's 4.
Okay. What we see here is if there's only fewer than 2,000 shops, there are lots and lots of cities, by numbers alone, cannot have a comic shop. That means that there are cities where people don't get into, never see a comic book, never get into the habit. They only hear about it on occasion, especially when Comic-Con is coming on or something of that sort. When comics start really going digital in the right way and start pushing and advertise correctly, that's part of it, you can then reach people in cities that don't have comic book shops or are 3 miles away from a comic book shop, can't get there, or aren't into it enough that they want to get there every single week, but they do want to follow a couple of things, and they don't want to get misplaced in there, and they don't really want to give an order to the store to hold, but they would like to get this. Or, you know what I'm saying? Somebody who's going in, say, just for Buffy or something of that sort. But if somebody's looking for a comic like Buffy, and they live in a city where, because they've heard about it and they know that Joss Whedon is doing it, and they live in a city where they can download it, I mean, where there's no comic shop, but on the other hand, they can download it in 90 seconds and read it, it's got to help the business.
Sure.
Because you're just giving better access to people who can't get to a comic book shop. If this were the way it was when I was a kid, it's very possible I may never have seen a comic book. I saw them at the newsstands, and there were 3 newsstands literally on my block that I never had to cross the street to get to. So I could find every comic book at a 9 years old without having to cross the street. You can't do that today. You have to, at minimum, you have to have a bike. At maximum, you need a car because it's 10 miles away. So, yeah, if you can download the comic and there's enough advertising to convince people to try it, and they like what they see, that has to help the industry. As comic stores shrink, that hurts the industry. So they have to find another way of doing it.
Well, I know, like I said, I live in Bakersfield, and I think according to the latest census, we have about 500,000 people here. And if you take in the outlying areas, you know, within a 20-mile radius, we have close to 700,000, and we don't have a single comic shop.
Okay.
None.
Case proven, right?
Yeah. We okay. had...
So we had three
when I moved here. The last one closed up 2 years ago.
Yeah, so how many kids out of 700,000 people will never, ever, ever see a comic book to get attached to them or realize that they may like a comic book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, when I moved here, there were 4 comic shops. The last one closed last year, and there's not a single one left. Like I said, I've moved strictly to trades. I don't even buy the floppies anymore because Diamond keeps shorting, you know, kept shorting my retailers, and that's what forced the last two out was, you show up expecting your Teen Titans on Wednesday, and sorry, Diamond shorted me. I may have some next week, and then the next month, they shorted me on Titans again.
Yeah.
Well, you know, at some point, you just quit collecting that title and you move on.
Right, but that'll never happen if you can download it yourself and not worry about it.
Sure, sure.
So I believe
that makes
that,
sense.
I believe that by necessity alone, I mean, look at the music industry. Yes, there's a lot of illegal downloads and all of that, but over the years, very few record stores survived, and there's almost none today. And I can't even think where I would go to buy a CD. I mean, I know that they're out there, but none of the regular stores sell them anymore. So you have to go online, so you're pretty much buying them at Amazon, or you're just downloading it directly to your iPod. So the same thing is going to happen just through necessity because there aren't enough shops. And the good shops should, I was in Australia a few weeks ago for a convention, and they have pop culture shops. They have every single comic that comes out, but the shops are huge, and they're pure pop culture. They are enormous. People who don't read comics come in there. People who do read comics come in there. I was just blown away by how great the stores are, and good comic shops are going to have to start thinking about the day when most comics start moving online just because it's too expensive to print them, and they need to have a lot of other type of merchandise, and they need to grow to become more mass market pop culture. And comics being a good part of it, but there are other things out there too, and they need to embrace what everybody who goes to Comic-Con, what everyone there likes, whether it's video games, whether it's movies, whether it's comics, whether it's whatever.
You have to be gone by 5:45, and we're getting kind of close to that. You know, we certainly don't want to keep you. You've been very generous with your time. I just wanted to take time to thank you for taking the time to talk to us and for answering our questions. And the last thing I want to know is, do you have a date as far as when games will be coming out? I know that you said the last 20 pages. I just want to make sure we get a good plug-in for you.
I have no idea what the current schedule is. And that's something only DC would know.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say that.
Well, Marv, that's all right. Just wanted to, you know, with you being so kind with your time, I just want to make sure that we gave you as good a plug as we could.
Well, thank you very much.
But thank you so much for your time, Marv. I appreciate you talking to us. Brian?
Okay.
Yeah, Marv, thank you very much. I really, particularly Crisis and Titans, even though when I first read them as a teenager, they still today stand as some of my favorite stories ever.
Well, thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.